Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander & Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. We're reading this week in our first new issue in several weeks. This is one is dated September 24th, 2021. The cover drawing this week has President Joe Biden. He is dressed up in Uncle Sam garb, although it's got a little more blue and white than red, white, and blue. And the pose looks like one of the older drawings. I think it was the I Want You in the U.S. Army. He's kind of pointing a finger with one hand. And in the other hand, he's holding forward a COVID vaccination card. Familiar looking that we've gotten used to. And the headline is No Jab, No Job. Will Biden's employer mandate persuade vaccine holdouts to give in? And that is our first main story, and we will start right there. GOP vows to fight Biden's vaccine mandates. What happened? With vaccinations still lagging in COVID-ravaged red states, President Biden opened a new front in the battle to combat the pandemic by ordering vaccination mandates for employees of large businesses and most healthcare workers, a move many Republican governors this week called tyranny. In his strongest actions yet to beat back a Delta variant surge that is overwhelming hospitals and killing some 1,500 Americans daily, Biden said the Department of Labor would use its regulatory power to safeguard workers to issue an emergency rule requiring employees of firms with more than 100 workers to get vaccinated or submit to weekly testing. The mandate will affect some 80 million workers. Biden also said he would mandate shots for federal contractors, most federal workers, and some 17 million healthcare workers in facilities that accept Medicare and Medicaid reimbursements. We've been patient, but our patience is wearing thin, he said, and your refusal has cost all of us. This is a pandemic of the unvaccinated. Some Republican governors responded with heated vows to challenge the constitutionality of the mandates in court. This is still America, and we still believe in freedom from tyrants, tweeted Mississippi Governor Tate Reeves. Texas Governor Greg Abbott called the mandates an assault on private businesses, while South Carolina Governor Henry McMaster pledged to fight them to the gates of hell. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis said he'd impose steep fines on local governments that mandated vaccines for municipal workers. At a news conference, he stood by silently as one municipal worker falsely claimed that the vaccine changes your RNA. Public health officials and some business leaders hailed the mandates. It's exactly what's needed at this moment, said Dr. Ashish Jha, dean of Brown University School of Public Health. It's going to fundamentally shift the arc of the current surge. Bob Harvey of the Greater Houston Partnership called the mandates a relief to business leaders grappling with the punishing Delta wave, which has already dampened the economic recovery. Employers simply must play a role in addressing this problem, he said. We've tried it every other way, what the editorial said. Biden's bold move was courageous and necessary, said the New York Times. Watching hundreds of thousands of Americans die of COVID-19 in 2020 was agonizing, but a replay in 2021 is infuriating. We now have at our disposal a rare medical miracle that could end this brutal pandemic. And still, tens of millions of Americans are thumbing their noses at it. We've tried carrots and mandates. We're the only meaningful option left and are perfectly legal. In 1905, the Supreme Court upheld a mandate to get the smallpox vaccine. Biden's business mandate is needless overkill and an executive overreach, said the Wall Street Journal. Federal code gives the Occupational Safety and Health Administration the authority to protect workers in specific instances, but using that power to mandate vaccines for 80 million Americans is stretching the government's authority. Persuasion would be a far better option, but once again, the progressive policy default is brute political force. What the columnists said. With only 54% of Americans fully vaccinated and COVID still raging, Biden's plan doesn't go far enough, said Leanna Wynn in the Washington Post. It's a tepid half measure that falls short of the dramatic reset the country needs. He should require vaccination for air and rail travel and urge local governments to mandate vaccination for patrons of restaurants, bars, and gyms, as San Francisco and New York City have done. Schools which already mandate vaccination against a host of diseases should require students over 12 to get protected against COVID, too. Biden is making a big mistake, said Robbie Suave in the New York Times. Using a sweeping and undemocratic expansion of federal authority to force vaccination risks shredding the social fabric of a country already being pulled apart by political tribalism. And mandates won't sway the most ardent anti-vaxxers, who are likely to see them as validation of their paranoid belief that the real goal is social control. If the president can mandate employers to require a medical procedure, said Andrew McCarthy in NationalReview.com, is there anything the federal government may not do? Courts should strike this mandate down. You don't hear businesses complaining, said Jordan Weissman in Slate.com. Most want their employees vaccinated, but have been too scared to mandate it. Biden has given them a gift. Polls show most Americans back mandates. In an Ipsos poll, 62% back vaccine requirements for workers, and in an AP poll, only 23% were opposed. In truth, anti-vaxxers are an obnoxious minority who are caterwauling while the quieter majority seethes at their selfish and destructive intransigence. Republican governors and legislators can now have their cake and eat it too, said Jonathan Last in TheBulwark.com. Thanks to Biden, they can assure us they believe in vaccination while railing against the tyranny of mandates. Meanwhile, as the vaccination debate rages, we're facing a 9/11 death toll every 48 hours. The controversy of the week is 9/11. How did it change America? The end of any empire has multiple causes, said Michelle Goldberg in the New York Times. But 20 years after the September 11th terrorist attacks, it's clear that the events of that awful morning catalyzed a period of decline that helped turn the United States into the debased, half-crazed, fading power that we are today. For weeks and months after 9/11, the nation was bound together by shared grief and a new spirit of unity as we braced for what felt like a civilizational battle on par with World War II. We now know, though, that the danger jihadist terrorism posed to our country, while serious, was never truly existential, unlike the damage we would do to ourselves. Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda may have not planned it that way, but their attack on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon triggered an epic of aggressive jingoism, ethnic profiling, escalating paranoia, torture, secret prisons, broken soldiers, dead civilians, and dashed imperial dreams, culminating in last month's shambolic withdrawal from Afghanistan. If the goal of terror is to terrorize, said Fred Kaplan in Slate.com, the 9/11 attacks were a success. Those 19 hijackers deeply destabilized our country and robbed it of its optimism. The paranoia seemed well-grounded at the time, said Garrett Graff in TheAtlantic.com. After the Twin Towers fell, there was a widespread assumption that the evil masterminds who'd unleashed such devastation would attack us again and again, perhaps with sleeper cells already in the U.S. When envelopes of anthrax powder started showing up in mailrooms, it confirmed this grim prognosis, and we succumbed to fear, embracing horrifying policies, including intrusive surveillance and torturing suspected terrorists that eroded our national character. All this was a gift to the far right, said Cynthia Miller Idris in foreignpolicy.com. Once the fringes of society, the peddlers of xenophobia, white supremacism, and Christian nationalism exploited fear of terrorism and Muslims to foster an angry, conspiratorial worldview that now underpins everything from vaccine skepticism to the January 6th Capitol insurrection. Don't listen to the hindsight brigade, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. The Bush administration did what it had to do to protect us from a shadowy enemy whose plans and capabilities were unknown. The fact that we were spared a second wave of mass casualty attacks surely vindicates Bush's decision to err on the side of overreaction. Let's also not despair over the current state of our society, said Gerald Sieb, also in the Journal. Our economy remains robust, our institutions have held, and our COVID vaccines are the world's best. This is still the one nation that people across the globe, from Afghanistan to Latin America, are literally dying to get into. Perhaps, said Omer Aziz in NYMag.com, but it's not the same nation Al-Qaeda attacked on that crisp fall morning 20 years ago. As an 11-year-old Muslim American, I got an early preview in the faces of my schoolmates of how the attacks would turn this once confident nation into the one that saw its way of life threatened by foreign enemies. It didn't take long for that fear of the other to turn inwards, as America's essential faith in the future was lost. That paved the way for a sourly pessimistic xenophobe, Donald Trump, to be elected president on a campaign built on fear and hatred. We were told repeatedly after 9/11 that this was now a battle of good versus evil. 20 years later, it feels like evil won. Here's our good week, bad week piece. It was a good week for artificial intelligence, with the launch of the Roomba J7 Plus robotic vacuum cleaner, which not only can identify dog poop and avoid smearing it all over the floor, like previous Roombas, but also can take a photo of the substance and text it to its owner. It was a good week for homes of the rich and famous. After $12 tickets went on sale in Mexico for a lottery to give away the modest safe house in Culiacan, occupied by drug kingpin Joaquin El Chapo Guzman. The house has been freshly painted, but the bathroom tunnel El Chapo used to escape police has been sealed with a concrete slab. It was a good week for woolly mammoths, who could make a comeback, after a biotech startup said it had $15 million in seed capital to use DNA technology to pursue the mammoth's de-extinction. But it was a bad week for mixed messages after Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez attended the celebrity-studied Met Gala in New York City wearing a white gown with the red-lettered slogan, "Tax the Rich." Tickets for the gala cost $30,000 apiece, although that cost was waived for AOC. It's a bad week for pandemic stress eating. After the CDC reported that the number of states in which 35% of the population is obese has soared from 9 in 2018 to 16 this year. Finally, it was a bad week for association and causation after rapper-singer Nicki Minaj told her 23 million Twitter followers that my cousin in Trinidad won't get the COVID vaccine because his friend got it, and his testicles became swollen. Fox News' Tucker Carlson invited Minaj's cousin's friend on his show, saying, "We want to hear your story." A short in other news piece right here in front of us. Democrats plan to raise taxes on the wealthy. House Democrats proposed this week to raise taxes nearly $2.1 trillion over 10 years with taxes on rich individuals and profitable corporations, but eschewed a wealth tax. The plan would lift taxes on income over $450,000 for couples and $400,000 for individuals to 39.6%, reverting to the top tax rate before the 2017 tax cut. The top capital gains rate would rise from 20 to 25%, but the bill mostly wouldn't cut into billionaires' fortunes or inheritances. Representative Dan Kildee, Democrat from Michigan, called the plan the boldest common denominator, saying, "What I don't want is another noble defeat." But it received criticism from progressive Democrats, with Oregon Senator Ron Wyden saying the proposal effectively exempts billionaires. The briefing this week is titled "The End of Roe v. Wade," with Supreme Court poised to revisit the landmark ruling this fall. At least 22 states are readying to outlaw abortion. Is Roe v. Wade at risk? Many legal experts think so, following the Supreme Court's 5-4 refusal this month to block a new Texas law that bans most abortions after 6 weeks of pregnancy. "Any court that took the right to abortion seriously would have stayed this law," said Florida State University law professor Mary Ziegler. "The real question is how and when the court overrules Roe." The court may eventually knock down the Texas law on constitutional grounds, but there will be no shortage of opportunities for it to chip away at Roe. Following Justice Amy Coney Barrett's confirmation last fall, which gave conservatives a 6-3 majority on the bench, the GOP-led state legislatures passed a slew of abortion restrictions aimed at triggering legal battles that will land at the court. In the first 7 months of 2021 alone, 90 new restrictions were enacted, more than in any year since Roe was decided in 1973. Some court watchers think the justices could upend long-standing precedent that a state may not ban abortion before fetal viability, usually adjudged at 24 weeks of pregnancy. When they hear arguments this fall over a Mississippi law banning nearly all terminations after 15 weeks. Has the abortion rate changed recently? It's been in steady decline since 1990, when a post-Roe high of 1.6 million abortions were performed in U.S. clinics. That number dropped to about 1 million in 2011, and 862,000 in 2017, according to the Guttmacher Institute, a research organization that supports abortion rights. New restrictions contributed to the decline, but they weren't the central driver, because 57% of the drop in terminations from 2011 to 2017 occurred in 18 states that didn't implement new barriers. Instead, a combination of factors likely explains the decline. An unknown number of women might be taking abortion pills they ordered online and so aren't showing up in the official tally. Abortions may also be dropping because fewer women are getting pregnant in the first place. Contraceptive use has increased in part because the 2010 Affordable Care Act expanded access to health care, which means more women can get prescription IUDs and contraceptive pills. Ushma Updaye, a reproductive health expert at the University of California, San Francisco, notes that data suggests that most fertile groups of Americans, young people ages 18 to 24, are having less sex, and so having fewer unplanned pregnancies. Where is access being restricted? Nearly 600 abortion restrictions have been passed at the state level over the past decade, most of them in the South, the Midwest, and the Plains. 33 states now require women to receive pre-abortion counseling, which can include speculation about when a fetus can feel pain or the supposed link between abortion and breast cancer, which is not backed by any scientific evidence. 25 states have a waiting period, usually 24 or 48 hours, between counseling and termination. In Kentucky, doctors must perform ultrasounds and make women listen to the fetal heartbeat before an abortion. 13 states regulate the size of corridors and/or procedure rooms at abortion clinics, and many have complex rules for licensing physicians and technicians. Anti-abortion lawmakers say these policies ensure women's safety. Critics call them a cynical attempt to regulate clinics out of existence. Have many abortion providers closed? The number of independent abortion clinics in the U.S. has dropped by a third in recent years, from 510 in 2012 to 337 last year. In at least 16 states, 95% of counties lack an abortion clinic. Missouri, North Dakota, South Dakota, West Virginia, Kentucky, and Mississippi have only one remaining abortion clinic each. Does prohibition stop abortion? History suggests not. In the 1950s and 60s, an estimated 200,000 to 1 million illegal abortions were performed each year in the U.S. Wealthy women would head abroad to get a termination or pay off a physician. Poor and desperate women visited back-alley abortionists or attempted terminations at home, poking knitting needles or coat hangers into their wombs, or having their cervixes filled with Lysol. Fatalities were common, and in some parts of the country, abortion was the leading cause of maternal death. Worldwide, abortion rates are highest today in countries with strict abortion bans, possibly because those nations also restrict contraceptive access. In the U.S., the abortion rate is about 11 per 1,000 women of childbearing age. In Mexico, where the Supreme Court last week decriminalized abortion, it's 34 per 1,000. Could abortion become illegal in the U.S.? 10 states have trigger laws in place that would outlaw abortion the moment the Supreme Court overturns Roe, and another 12 states are thought likely to pass new bans. About 100,000 fewer legal abortions would be carried out each year if Roe were scrapped, according to a study by Middlebury College. 41% of women of childbearing age would see their nearest abortion clinic close, and they'd have to travel an average of 279 miles to reach a facility, up from 35 miles today. But in more than half of the U.S., access to legal abortions would likely be unchanged. A post-Roe United States isn't one in which abortion isn't legal at all, said Caitlin Knowles-Myers, an economist at Middlebury. It's one in which there's tremendous inequality in abortion access. We'll read a few of the best columns of the week, starting with two from the U.S. The GOP's coup attempt isn't over. The storming of the Capitol on January 6th was only half of a coup attempt, the less important half, said Kevin Williamson. The assault on democracy is still going strong, as Donald Trump's allies in Congress and state legislatures stonewall the investigation of the Capitol attack and call for more bogus audits of the 2020 election. Country over party conservatives like me can't go home to a pro-insurrection GOP. Before January 6th, cooperation between the Trumpist populists and traditional conservatives might have been possible. But there really isn't any middle ground on overthrowing the government, and that is what Trump and his allies were up to, both by stoking the mob and by pressuring state election officials to nullify the result. They were stopped by a thin gray line of bureaucratic fortitude last November, as principled Republicans in several swing states refused to buckle to intense pressure. But in new election laws, GOP-controlled states have purged or sidelined those officials, and Republican officials are either downplaying January 6 or celebrating it. Clearly, the stage is being set to overturn future elections. When it comes to a coup, you're either in or you're out. The Republican Party is leaning pretty strongly toward in. Afghanistan's doomed Ponzi scheme. Afghanistan was a Ponzi scheme sold to the American public, said Alan Richards and Stephen Simon. That's why a sudden chaotic collapse of the country's U.S.-backed army and government was inevitable. Ponzi schemes like Bernie Madoff's are built on a series of lies that are sustained by naive belief and constant infusions of new cash. After toppling the Taliban, the Bush administration managed to persuade Americans that the U.S. could magically transform a backward theocratic nation into a modern, functional, pro-Western democracy. Rather than admit this scheme wasn't working, Bush and subsequent presidents poured in new money, soldiers, and contractors. Afghan leaders stuffed their own pockets with our aid, paying ghost soldiers who existed only on paper. The government and army we propped up were massively corrupt, which is why most Afghans viewed them with deep distrust and cynicism. Once it became clear that President Biden was serious about the withdrawal agreed to by President Trump, the scheme collapsed, and there was a rush for the door. The Afghan army and government melted away. An orderly departure may sound good in theory, but when occupying powers give up, panic and chaos always follow. This is an international column from China. Launching a new cultural revolution? Beijing is going to war with celebrity culture, said Mimi Lau in South China Morning Post. In an unusual move, the Communist Party's top anti-graft watchdog last month published a report condemning shocking misconduct by Chinese pop stars and actors and the extreme behavior of the mainland's unruly celebrity fan culture. In some cases, fans have resorted to online abuse, doxing, publishing the personal details of foes online, and the stalking of celebrities. From now on, virtual fan communities will be closely regulated and celebrity popularity rankings, a key feature of those groups, banned. More than 1,300 groups have already been shut down. The crackdown appears to have been sparked by last month's arrest of Chinese-Canadian singer Chris Wu on rape charges, after which his fans rallied online and pledged to organize a prison break to free him. Wu is just one of a roster of big entertainment names to have fallen from grace in recent weeks. The actress Xing Shuang was ordered to pay $46.1 million for tax evasion in late August, only a day after the online presence of Zhao Wei, one of China's biggest movie stars, was mysteriously scrubbed with no official explanation. This morality crusade has taken down some of the country's most famous faces, said Gemma Williams in JingDaily.com. Heartthrob actor Zhang Zihan was blacklisted after photos surfaced of him at a shrine in Japan that contains the remains of World War II war criminals. And boy band member Lucas Huang vanished from public view after he was accused of taking sexual advantage of fans. Even Jack Ma, co-founder of the tech colossus Alibaba, dropped out of sight after he gave a speech criticizing Chinese regulators. His company was then fined an eye-watering $2.8 billion for antitrust violations. It's all part of President Xi Jinping's common prosperity policy, under which he has called for a clamping down on high incomes and redistribution of wealth. By cracking down on adored stars, Xi is reminding people that no one in the country is beyond reproach. Xi's flurry of sudden edicts suggests that the country may be in the midst of a Cultural Revolution 2.0, said Bill Birtles in abc.net.au. In recent weeks, the party has banned TV shows featuring effeminate men and barred minors from playing online video games on school nights. Xi Jinping thought has been added to the national curriculum for elementary schools, so youngsters now read textbooks in which they learn that Grandpa Xi always cares about us. What he really cares about is the party, said Diana Shuleva and Nikki Asia, and he understands that grotesque inequality could threaten its rule. That explains why Xi in July barred private tutoring companies from making a profit, a decision that devastated a $100 billion a year industry that gives the children of wealthy parents a big leg up and forces less well-off parents to spend a fortune trying to keep up. This campaign to assert Communist Party control over every sphere of economic and social life in China is only just the beginning. The last word, our in-depth article honoring the 20th anniversary of 9/11 is titled The Children of 9/11. Many children lost parents to the terrorist attacks of 9/11, said Brittany Shamus and Michael Rosenwald in the Washington Post. But there is a unique sorrow for those who lost fathers they never even got to meet. There is grief, but no memories. There are photos, but none together. There were no high fives on the softball field, no fist bumps at the hockey rink, no bear hug after graduating high school. For the children who weren't yet born when their fathers died in the September 11th terrorist attacks, more than 100, according to Tuesday's Children, an organization that counsels them, their fathers exist only as a lifelong, heartbreaking absence. Following the 20th anniversary of 9/11, here are three stories of children who entered the world after their fathers had already left. I pretended my dad was alive just so I wouldn't feel left out. Robin Ornato, born January 31st, 2002. The first time she remembers having to make a Father's Day card at school, Robin Ornato was in first grade. As a teacher explained the assignment, folding construction paper to resemble a man's shirt and tie, the six-year-old felt a sadness creeping in. She knew her dad was gone, lost in what she only vaguely understood as some sort of accident. For a moment, Robin sat wondering what to do. Then she remembered something her mom always told her, that it was okay to talk to her dad as if he was still there with them, that in a way he was still there. She grabbed a piece of purple paper for the shirt and turquoise for the tie. On the inside, she was supposed to fill in details about him. She thought of things other people had told her, and an older student helped her write them down. Funny and fun, and you were like me. I pretended my dad was alive, Robin recalled recently, just so I wouldn't feel left out. It was something she would do again and again at her family's home in Corona, California. Robin's creations, a tile with her small handprint, paper planes scrawled with XOXOXO and I love you, sit in what she refers to as Dad's room. On the walls, photos show Ruben Ornato wearing the smile everyone says his daughter shares. A display case holds a folded American flag, memorabilia from a year's worth of commemorative ceremonies, and a palm-sized model of the Pentagon. Propped up on a shelf below the flag is the seating chart for American Airlines Flight 77. Robin can't remember when she grasped what it all meant. She thinks it might have been fourth or fifth grade. As she starts her sophomore year at the University of California at Irvine, where she is studying biological sciences, she still feels confused when she thinks about what happened to her dad and why. A 39-year-old engineer at Boeing, he was killed when terrorists hijacked the plane he was on and crashed it into the Pentagon. His daughter calls it the incident, or the event. As she's grown older, her mom, Sheila, has told her more details about their loss, how she struggled that first trimester of pregnancy, and how Reuben, wanting to be at her side, interrupted his business trip in D.C. to fly home on September 11th instead of September 17th. How she sobbed watching the news that day. Robin was the first and only child for the couple who were married just that year. In the happy months after they found out about the pregnancy, Reuben liked to rest his head against Sheila's stomach and listen. They knew they were having a girl, but hadn't decided on a name. Ashley was an early favorite. After his death, Sheila chose Robin because it sounded like Reuben. She didn't know how she'd deliver their baby without him. Somehow, she got through it. Robin Galero Ornato arrived on January 31, 2002, welcomed by relatives of both parents and by multiple godparents. So many of Reuben's friends and co-workers asked, and Sheila didn't want to tell anyone no. Robin's photo hung outside her dad's old office, where one Boeing employee told a company publication she was everybody's baby. Surrounded by that circle, Robin grew up hearing stories about her namesake. She knows that he was quiet but decisive, confident enough to ask her mother when they were introduced, "So when are we going on a date?" She knows that before he proposed, he had a friend teach him Tagalog so he could ask her to marry her in her native language. And she knows he wasn't a fan of the water but loved climbing mountains, which Robin finds funny because she spent years on the swim team, and she's a little afraid of heights. Other details she's gleaned from dozens of letters and cards her mom tucked into a binder with an American flag on the cover. They arrived in the weeks after 9/11, addressed to Sheila and baby Ornato. When she feels alone, Robin reaches for the binder. Every time I put on the Army uniform, I feel connected to him. Luke Taylor, born October 25th, 2001. Luke Taylor always knew he had a mother and father in heaven, though as a child he didn't really know what that meant. Then one night, when he was 8 or 9 years old, he wandered into the office of the man he called Dad. As the two watched TV together, Luke asked for the first time about the memorabilia on the shelves. There were dog tags, a folded American flag, and a photograph of his grandfather commissioning two sons, Dean and Kip Taylor, into the Army. Then came the long conversation that Luke would remember for years to come. Dean Taylor tried to break it down on a third grade level. He explained that Kip Taylor, Luke's biological father and Dean's brother, was killed in the September 11th attack on the Pentagon before Luke was even born. That Nancy Taylor, Luke's biological mother, died of breast cancer just over 2 years later. And that he and his wife, Donna, had agreed to Nancy's wish that they raise Luke and his older brother as their own. I think I remember it most because he started crying. And my dad does not cry very often, Luke said. Like I can count on one hand how many times my dad has cried throughout my last 19 years of life. Luke was born 6 weeks after American Airlines Flight 77 crashed into the Pentagon. killing all 64 people aboard the plane and 125 inside the building. Lieutenant Colonel Kip Taylor, a 38-year-old aide to the Army's Deputy Chief of Staff for Personnel, was among the dead. Just over an hour before the attack, Kip had sent friends and family an email rhapsodizing about how fatherhood had changed his life. He and Nancy saw their 20-month-old son and the one on the way, both conceived through IVF, as miracles. After kids, there are days that just get going when you say, "Hi, honey, I'm home," he wrote. "My conclusion is that what we do until that moment pales in comparison to what we do after that point in the day." 20 years later, the message brings a sense of peace to the son he never met. "It shows that his father was happy at the end," Luke says. "You do all this planning in life. Hey, I want kids. I want a good job. I want to settle down with a good wife and be a dad." He's like, "I'm finally here." Married for almost 20 years on September 11, 2001, Dean and Donna never planned to have children. After Nancy's death, they rededicated their lives to the two little boys. Dean retired from the Army, getting a job at the Transportation Security Administration, and Donna became a stay-at-home mom. They hewed to a written list of requests Nancy left behind. Luke, who marvels at the sacrifices Dean and Donna made, believes they were meant to be parents. "There's no way of knowing how his life would have turned out if the attacks hadn't happened," he said. "I don't really do the whole what-if thing," Luke said. "I mean, you can go back in history, and it's like if this hadn't happened, the world would be a completely different place." "Yeah, that's true. But it did happen. So here we are." At Texas Christian University, Luke is in the Reserve Officer Training Corps, carrying on the family military tradition. One of the other cadets is the son of a long-ago friend of Kip's. "Every time I put on the Army uniform as a cadet, I feel connected to him because that's what he wore," Luke said. There's one more thing that might strengthen their connection, a time capsule. For years, the plastic container has been waiting in storage, taped shut and tucked away until he turns 21. Nancy put it together before her death at 39. Luke has been told letters and audio recordings are inside. Sometimes his lost parents can feel almost like distant relatives. He's hoping that the time capsule brings them into sharper focus. "It's like I'm missing something," he said, "but I don't know what I'm missing." He wasn't supposed to be there. Claudia Sierkowski, born May 3rd, 2002. Before her family dug the camcorder and cassette tapes out of storage, Claudia Sierkowski had only seen her dad in photographs. She watched eagerly last winter as one of the late 1990s home videos filled the living room television screen. Finally, she would get a glimpse of him in action, the man she'd heard about all her life. But when Norbert P. Sierkowski made his first appearance, his daughter almost missed it. He was speaking off camera, his voice deep, confident, and painfully unfamiliar. "It took my mom to point it out that it was him," she said. "And that really upset me, because if I were to hear him down the street, I wouldn't have known him." Months later, the memory still gnaws at Claudia. She mourns her father every day, and yet there is so much she will never know about him. She was born on May 3rd, 2002, nearly 8 months after the day he left for work and didn't come home. While training to be a mechanic, her dad was earning extra money putting up wallpaper. That Tuesday morning, a supervisor sent him to the World Trade Center to fix a mistake another worker had made at the Cantor Fitzgerald offices. The last Claudia's mother, Ursula Hurd, her outgoing, adventurous husband of 5 years, was on the 104th floor, several stories above where American Airlines Flight 11 tore into the North Tower. "He wasn't supposed to be there," Claudia said, shaking her head. Thinking about it made her mad. Every year on September 11th, Claudia posts a tribute to her dad on social media. I miss you more than anyone could ever understand, she wrote on Instagram in 2018. Below a picture of his name inscribed in bronze at the 9/11 memorial in New York. Otherwise, she mostly keeps her loss to herself. She doesn't want people treating her differently out of pity. If it had happened before, someone would have discovered her dad died in the World Trade Center and suddenly want to sit next to her at lunch. My junior year of high school, when somebody found out, they instantly went on the phone and posted a photo of me, Claudia recalled. And they were like, this girl is so strong, blah, 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 things like that. And I've never once had a full conversation with them. So she mourns more quietly. She reads as much as she can about 9/11, feeling less lonely when she learns about the other people who lost someone that day. Her dad smiles out from a photograph she keeps in her bedroom, next to a cheerleading trophy and her diploma from Naples High School. She talks to the image of him every day before she goes to sleep, sometimes out loud, sometimes in her head. She tells him the kinds of things she'd tell him if he were at the dinner table, how her day went at her job as a secretary at Naples Hospital, or in her classes at Florida Southwestern State College, where she's studying law. What she has planned for the next day? I'll ask him a question, even though I know I'm not going to get an answer, Claudia said. Like, what does he think? Is he proud? This was adapted from a story that originally appeared in the Washington Post. On the Talking Points page, we'll start with an article titled, Texas Abortion Law Republicans Aren't Celebrating. A new Texas law eradicates nearly all abortion care, said Mary Tuma in NYTimes.com, providing a preview of the future in Republican-run states if a flurry of new anti-abortion bills is allowed to stand. In a stunning move, the Supreme Court recently voted 5-4 to let Texas ban take effect, with Chief Justice John Roberts joining the court's liberals in dissent. The law bans abortion once an ultrasound picks up the embryonic electrical activity it calls a fetal heartbeat, usually detectable about 6 weeks into a pregnancy, before most women realize they're pregnant, and before about 85% of women seek an abortion. Heartbeat bills enacted in at least a dozen other states have been blocked by courts, but Texas' version is particularly insidious. To avoid overtly violating Roe v. Wade, the state doesn't enforce the law, but instead deputizes private citizens to file lawsuits against anyone who aids or abets an abortion, including nurses, receptionists, boyfriends, mothers, best friends, and Uber drivers. Plaintiffs are eligible to collect a $10,000 bounty plus legal costs. The law has effectively repealed Roe, at least for now, said Melissa Jeltson in NYMag.com. Abortion clinics in Oklahoma, Louisiana, New Mexico, Colorado, and Kansas are being inundated with pregnant refugees from Texas past the six-week limit. What happens to those women if those states successfully find ways to ban abortion, too? Despite hysterics about the end of abortion rights, said the Wall Street Journal, the Supreme Court ruled properly. The conservative justices rightly let the law take effect, waiting for an abortion provider to seek to dismiss a lawsuit in the coming weeks, at which point courts will have the authority to intervene. Still, Texas Republicans have handed Democrats a political grenade to hurt the anti-abortion cause. The law has no exceptions for rape and incest, and inviting private citizens to snitch on and sue one another undermines the pro-life movement. Putting bounties on abortion providers will only alienate people we pro-lifers are trying to win over, said David French in the Dispatch.com. Strategies designed to ban abortions do not necessarily help end abortion. What if a woman miscarries and grieving family members must spend thousands of dollars in legal fees to defend an allegation she had an abortion? What if blue states deputize citizens to sue anyone who sells a handgun? Even if Texas law is unlikely to survive legal challenges, abortion rights advocates have reason to be nervous, said Sarah Isker in Politico.com. Texas ban clearly violates the undue burden standard for abortion laws established in Casey versus Planned Parenthood. That 1992 ruling barred states from banning abortion access before a fetus is viable outside the womb, usually defined as about 24 weeks into pregnancy. The real challenge to Casey will come this fall when the Supreme Court hears arguments in a case challenging Mississippi's ban on abortion after 15 weeks. As of today, 22 states have laws that would further restrict abortion if Casey is overturned. That's long overdue, said Catherine Jean Lopez in NationalReview.com. Since Roe and Casey, sonograms and other medical advances have let us see the humanity of the developing fetus even early in pregnancy. Following the science has become a pandemic mantra, especially for the left. And when it comes to abortion, the science is clear. It takes a human life. Medical experts concede that viability is a moving target, said Mona Sharin in TheBulwark.com. It was considered to be about 28 weeks when Roe was decided, then moved back to 24 weeks. There are cases of babies surviving at even younger ages, including a baby born last year in Minnesota, just 21 weeks and 2 days into its mother's pregnancy, weighing less than a pound. He's now 1 year old. It would be far healthier for our society if states had the authority to set their own abortion laws. The GOP has conceded for the first time in almost half a century in outlawing almost all abortions in a state, said Mark Joseph Stern in Slate.com. So why aren't Republican elected officials celebrating? The most obvious answer is that Republicans are now the dog that caught the car, fearful of the political ramifications of their own victory. For years, red states have passed abortion restrictions, expecting them to be struck down by federal courts. Republicans would rail against their rulings and fundraise off the outrage they fomented. Now, with Roe effectively nullified in Texas, the cruel realities of forcing women to travel hundreds of miles to obtain an abortion are in plain view. Before the conservative justices strike down Roe, they should look at Republicans' reactions to their own ostensible triumph in Texas. Boosters, are they needed? To booster or not to booster, that is the question facing U.S. public health experts, said Dana Smith in Fortune.com. Last month, President Biden announced that third Pfizer and Moderna doses would be widely available after September 20th. After evidence mounted that COVID vaccines, especially Pfizer's, offer waning anti-infection protection over time. Yet even as the Delta variant still ravages the unvaccinated and produces tens of thousands of breakthrough cases, the CDC and FDA have since split with the White House, claiming that more data are needed. Protections against hospitalization, though, have apparently dipped from 95 to 85%. Israel has already begun boosters of Pfizer, with studies showing a 70 to 84% reduction in breakthrough infections. But while public health experts generally agree that seniors, healthcare workers, and immunocompromised people should get boosters, for the rest of us, the reality is more complicated. Some experts insist that the government should give priority to vaccinating the unvaccinated, who are far more likely to get life-threatening cases, said Sumathi Reddy in the Wall Street Journal. But even ostensibly mild or moderate breakthrough cases can make a person miserable for a week and trigger symptoms of long COVID. Dr. Robert Wachter of the University of California suggested that a third Pfizer dose is a no-brainer, and it can be obtained at zero cost and essentially zero risk. Other experts are focused on the bigger picture, said Spencer Bocott Lindell in the New York Times. If the goal is to prevent as many deaths as possible, boosters for the vaccinated are not a meaningful way to achieve it. Epidemiologist and former Biden advisor Dr. Celine Grounder worries that the president is caving to anxious Americans who fear breakthroughs. The rest of the world is also watching, said Professor Govind Prasad, William Fisk Parker, and Ezekiel Emanuel in the Boston Globe. The White House maintains that an American booster program will not impede global vaccination, and that the best way to meet that need is to ramp up production overseas. But low-income nations have less than 1% of their population fully vaccinated. To conserve precious vaccines, the Biden administration should consider fractional doses as boosters after determining how much mRNA is needed to reactivate antibodies. That way, we can still meet our global obligations and protect everyone from more harmful variants. And a short note in the same vein, about 2.3 billion of the world's 7.8 billion people are now fully vaccinated, according to Oxford University's Our World in Data project. Epidemiologists estimate that 1.1 billion people have been infected by COVID-19. And we'll finish out the hour with a quote from Toni Morrison, who says, "The function of freedom is to free someone else." With that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander & Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, please give us a call, 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.